Those who doubted Bayes' existence were right about one thing. He never published a single scientific paper. We know little of his life, but he proudly pursued his work for his own pleasure and did not feel much need to communicate it. In that and other respects, he and Jacob Bernoulli were opposites. For Bernoulli resisted the study of theology, whereas Bayes embraced it. And Bernoulli sought fame, whereas Bayes showed no interest in it. Finally, Bernoulli's theorem concerns how many heads to expect if, say, you plan to conduct many tosses of a balanced coin, whereas Bayes investigated Bernoulli's original goal, the issue of how certain you can be that a coin is balanced if you observe a certain number of heads. The theory for which Bayes is known today came to light on December 23, 1763, when another chaplain and mathematician, Richard Price, read a paper to the Royal Society, Britain's National Academy of Science. The paper, by Bayes, was titled An Essay Toward Solving a Problem in the Doctrine of Chances, and was published in the Royal Society's Philosophical Transactions in 1764. Bayes had left Price the article in his will, along with £100, referring to Price as, I suppose, a preacher at Newington Green. Bayes died 4 months after writing his will. Despite Bayes' casual reference, Richard Price was not just another obscure preacher. He was a well-known advocate of freedom of religion, a friend of Benjamin Franklin's, a man entrusted by Adam Smith to critique parts of a draft of The Wealth of Nations, and a well-known mathematician. He is also credited with founding actuary science, a field he developed when, in 1765, three men from an insurance company, the Equitable Society, requested his assistance. 6 years after that encounter, he published his work in a book titled Observations on Reversionary Payments. Though the book served as a Bible for actuaries well into the 19th century, because of some poor data and estimation methods, he appears to have underestimated life expectancies. The resulting inflated life insurance premiums enriched his pals at the Equitable Society. The hapless British government, on the other hand, based annuity payments on Price's tables and took a bath when the pensioners did not proceed to keel over at the predicted rate. As I mentioned, Bayes developed conditional probability in an attempt to answer the same question that inspired Bernoulli. How can we infer underlying probability from observation? If a drug just cured 45 out of 60 patients in a clinical trial, what does that tell you about the chances the drug will work well on the next patient? If it worked for 600,000 out of 1 million patients, the odds are obviously good that its chances of working are close to 60%. But what can you conclude from a smaller trial? Bayes also answered another question. If, before the trial, you had reason to believe that the drug was only 50% effective, how much weight should the new data carry in your future assessments? Most of our life experiences are like that. We observe a relatively small sample of outcomes from which we infer information and make judgments about the qualities that produced those outcomes. How should we make those inferences? Bayes approached the problem via a metaphor. Imagine we are supplied with a square table and two balls. We roll the first ball onto the table in a manner that makes it equally probable that the ball will come to rest at any point. Our job is to determine, without looking, where along the left-right axis the ball stopped. Our tool in this is the second ball, which we may repeatedly roll onto the table in the same manner as the first. With each roll, a collaborator notes whether the ball comes to rest to the right or the left of the place where the first ball landed. At the end, he informs us of the total number of times the second ball landed in each of the two general locations. The first ball represents the unknown that we wish to gain information about. The second ball represents the evidence we managed to obtain. If the second ball lands consistently to the right of the first, we can be pretty confident that the first ball rests toward the left side of the table. If it lands less consistently to the right, we might be less confident of that conclusion. Or we might guess that the first ball is situated farther to the right. Bayes showed how to determine, based on the data of the second ball, the precise probability that the first ball is at any given point on the left-right axis. And he showed how, given the additional data, one should revise one's initial estimate. In Bayesian terminology, the initial estimates are called prior probabilities, and the new guesses, posterior probabilities. Bayes concocted this game because it models many of the decisions we make in life. In the drug trial example, the position of the first ball represents the drug's true effectiveness, and the reports regarding the second ball represent the patient data. The position of the first ball could also represent a film's appeal, product quality, driving skill, hard work, stubbornness, talent, ability, or whatever it is that determines the success or failure of a certain endeavor. The reports on the second ball would then represent our observations or the data we collect. Bayes' theory shows how to make assessments and then adjust them in the face of new data. Today, Bayesian analysis is widely employed throughout science and industry. For instance, models employed to determine car insurance rates include a mathematical function describing, per unit of driving time, your personal probability of having zero, one, or more accidents. Consider for our purposes a simplified model that places everyone in one of two categories. High risk, which includes drivers who average at least one accident a year, and low risk, which includes drivers who average less than one. If, when you apply for insurance, you have a driving record that stretches back 20 years without an accident, or one that goes back 20 years with 37 accidents, the insurance company can be pretty sure which category to place you in. But if you are a new driver, should you be classified as low risk? A kid who obeys the speed limit and volunteers to be the designated driver? Or high risk? A kid who races down Main Street, swigging from a half-empty $2 bottle of Boone's Farm apple wine. Since the company has no data on you, no idea of the position of the first ball, it might assign you an equal prior probability of being in either group. Or it might use what it knows about the general population of new drivers and start you off by guessing that the chances you are high risk are, say, 1 in 3. In that case, the company would model you as a hybrid, 1/3 high risk and 2/3 low risk, and charge you 1/3 the price it charges high risk drivers, plus 2/3 the price it charges low risk drivers. Then, after a year of observation, that is, after one of Bayes' second balls has been thrown, the company can employ the new datum to reevaluate its model, adjust the 1/3 and 2/3 proportions it previously assigned, and recalculate what it ought to charge. If you have had no accidents, the proportion of low risk and low price it assigns you will increase. If you have had 2 accidents, it will decrease. The precise size of the adjustment is given by Bayes' theory. In the same manner, the insurance company can periodically adjust its assessments in later years to reflect the fact that you were accident-free, or that you twice had an accident while driving the wrong way down a one-way street, holding a cell phone with your left hand and a donut with your right. That is why insurance companies can give out good driver discounts. The absence of accidents elevates the posterior probability that a driver belongs in a low-risk group. Obviously, many of the details of Bayes' theory are rather complex. But as I mentioned when I analyzed the two-daughter problem, the key to his approach is to use new information to prune the sample space and adjust probabilities accordingly. In the two-daughter problem, the sample space was initially boy-boy, boy-girl, girl-boy, and girl-girl, but reduces to boy-girl, girl-boy, and girl-girl If you learn that one of the children is a girl, making the chances of a two-girl family 1 in 3. Let's apply the same simple strategy to see what happens if you learn that one of the children is a girl named Florida. In the girl named Florida problem, our information concerns not just the gender of the children, but also, for the girls, the name. Since our original sample space should be a list of all the possibilities, in this case, it is a list of both gender and name. Denoting girl named Florida by girl F and girl not named Florida by girl NF. We write the sample space this way. Boy, 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 girl F, boy, girl NF, girl F, boy, girl NF, boy, girl NF, girl F, girl F, girl NF, girl NF, girl NF, and girl F, girl F. Now, the pruning. Since we know that one of the children is a girl named Florida, we can reduce the sample space to boy, girl F, girl F, boy, girl NF, girl F, girl F, girl NF, and girl F, girl F. That brings us to another way in which this problem differs from the two-daughter problem. Here, because it is not equally probable that a girl's name is or is not Florida, not all the elements of the sample space are equally probable. In 1935, the last year for which the Social Security Administration provided statistics on the name, about 1 in 30,000 girls were christened Florida. Since the name has been dying out, for the sake of argument, let's say that today the probability of a girl's being named Florida is 1 in 1 million. That means that if we learn that a particular girl's name is not Florida, it's no big deal. But if we learn that a particular girl's name is Florida, in a sense we fit the jackpot. The chances of both girls being named Florida, even if we ignore the fact that parents tend to shy away from giving their children identical names, are therefore so small, we are justified in ignoring that possibility. That leaves us with just boy, girl F, girl F, boy, girl NF, girl F, and girl F, girl NF, which are, to a very good approximation, equally likely. Since two of the four, or half, of the elements in the sample space are families with two girls, the answer is not 1 in 3, as it was in the two-daughter problem, but 1 in 2. The added information, your knowledge of the girl's name, makes a difference. One way to understand this, if it still seems puzzling, is to imagine that we gather into a very large room 75 million families that have two children, at least one of whom is a girl. As the two-daughter problem taught us, there will be about 25 million two-girl families in that room and 50 million one-girl families, 25 million in which one girl is the older child and an equal number in which she is the younger. Next comes the pruning. We ask that only the families that include a girl named Florida remain. Since Florida is a 1 in 1 million name, about 50 of the 50 million one-girl families will remain. And of the 25 million two-girl families, 50 of them will also get to stay. 25 because their firstborn is named Florida, and another 25 because their younger girl has that name. It's as if the girls are lottery tickets and the girls named Florida are the winning tickets. Although there are twice as many one-girl families as two-girl families, the two-girl families each have two tickets. So the one-girl families and the two-girl families will be about equally represented among the winners. I have described the girl named Florida problem in potentially annoying detail, the kind of detail that sometimes lands me on the do not invite list for my neighbor's parties. I did this not because I expect you to run into this situation, I did it because the context is simple. And the same kind of reasoning will bring clarity to many situations that really are encountered in life. Now let's talk about a few of those. My most memorable encounter with the Reverend Bayes came one Friday afternoon in 1989, when my doctor told me by telephone that the chances were 999 out of 1,000 that I'd be dead within a decade. He added, "I'm really sorry," as if he had some patients to whom he would say he is sorry but not mean it. Then he answered a few questions about the course of the disease and hung up, presumably to offer another patient his or her Friday afternoon newsflash. It is hard to describe or even remember exactly how the weekend went for me, but let's just say I did not go to Disneyland. Given my death sentence, why am I still here, able to write about it? The adventure started when my wife and I applied for life insurance. The application procedure involved a blood test. A week or two later, we were turned down. The ever-economical insurance company sent the news in two brief letters that were identical, except for a single additional word in the letter to my wife. My letter stated that the company was denying me insurance because of the results of your blood test. My wife's letter stated that the company was turning her down because of the results of your husband's blood test. When the added word husband's proved to be the extent of the clues the kind-hearted insurance company was willing to provide about our uninsurability, I went to my doctor on a hunch and took an HIV test. It came back positive. Though I was too shocked initially to quiz him about the odds he quoted, I later learned that he had derived my 1 in 1,000 chance of being healthy from the following statistic. The HIV test produced a positive result when the blood was not infected with the AIDS virus in only 1 in 1,000 blood samples. That might sound like the same message he passed on, but it wasn't. My doctor had confused the chances that I would test positive if I was not HIV positive with the chances that I would not be HIV positive if I tested positive. To understand my doctor's error, let's employ Bayes' method. The first step is to define the sample space. We could include everyone who has ever taken an HIV test, but we'll get a more accurate result if we employ a bit of additional relevant information about me and consider only heterosexual, non-IV drug-abusing white male Americans who have taken the test. We'll see later what kind of difference this makes. Now that we know whom to include in the sample space, let's classify the members of the space. Instead of boy and girl, here the relevant classes are those who tested positive and are HIV positive, true positives. Those who tested positives but are not positive, false positives. Those who tested negative and are HIV negative, true negatives. And those who tested negative but are HIV positive, false negatives. Finally, we ask, how many people are there in each of these classes? Suppose we consider an initial population of 10,000. We can estimate, employing statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that in 1989, about one in those 10,000 heterosexual, non-IV drug-abusing white male Americans who got tested were infected with HIV. Assuming that the false negative rate is near zero, that means that about one person out of every 10,000 will test positive due to the presence of the infection. In addition, since the rate of false positives is, as my doctor had quoted, 1 in 1,000, there will be about 10 others who are not infected with HIV, but will test positive anyway. The other 9,989 of the 10,000 men in the sample space will test negative. Now let's prune the sample space to include only those who tested positive. We end up with 10 people who are false positives and one true positive. In other words, only 1 in 11 people who test positive are really infected with HIV. My doctor told me that the probability that the test was wrong, and I was in fact healthy, was 1 in 1,000. He should have said, "Don't worry, the chances are better than 10 out of 11 that you are not infected." In my case, the screening test was apparently fooled by certain markers that were present in my blood, even though the virus this test was screening for was not present. It is important to know the false positive rate when assessing any diagnostic test. For example, a test that identifies 99% of all malignant tumors sounds very impressive. But I can easily devise a test that identifies 100% of all tumors. All I have to do is report that everyone I examine has a tumor. The key statistic that differentiates my test from the useful one is that my test will produce a high rate of false positives. But this incident illustrates that knowledge of the false positive rate is not sufficient to determine the usefulness of a test. You must also know how the false positive rate compares with the true prevalence of the disease. If the disease is rare, even a low false positive rate does not mean that a positive test implies you have the disease. If a disease is common, a positive result is much more likely to be meaningful. To see how the true prevalence affects the implications of a positive test, let's suppose now that I had been homosexual and tested positive. Assume that in the male gay community, the chance of infection among those being tested in 1989 was about 1%. That means that in the results of 10,000 tests, we would not find one, as before, but 100 true positives to go with the 10 false positives. So in this case, the chances that a positive test meant I was infected would have been 10 out of 11. That's why, when assessing test results, it is good to know whether you are in a high-risk group. Bayes' theory shows that the probability that A will occur if B occurs will generally differ from the probability that B will occur if A occurs. Do not account for this as a common mistake in the medical profession. For instance, in studies in Germany and the United States, researchers asked physicians to estimate the probability that an asymptomatic woman between the ages of 40 and 50 who has a positive mammogram actually has breast cancer if 7% of mammograms show cancer when there is none. In addition, the doctors were told that the actual incidence was about 0.8%, and that the false negative rate about 10%. Putting that all together, one can use Bayes' methods to determine that a positive mammogram is due to cancer in only about 9% of the cases. In the German group, however, 1/3 of the physicians concluded that the probability was about 90%, and the median estimate was 70%. In the American group, 95 out of 100 physicians estimated the probability to be around 75%. Similar issues arise in drug testing in athletes. Here again, the oft-quoted but not directly relevant number is the false positive rate. This gives a distorted view of the probability that an athlete is guilty. For example, Mary Decker Slaney, a world-class runner and 1983 world champion in the 1500 and 3000-meter race, was trying to make a comeback when, at the U.S. Olympic trials in Atlanta in 1996, she was accused of doping violations consistent with testosterone use. After various deliberations, the IAAF, known officially since 2001 as the International Association of Athletics Federations, ruled that Slaney was guilty of a doping offense, effectively ending her career. According to some of the testimony in the Slaney case, the false positive rate for the test to which her urine was subjected could have been as high as 1%. This probably made many people comfortable that her chance of guilt was 99%, but, as we have seen, that is not true. Suppose, for example, 1,000 athletes were tested. 1 in 10 was guilty, and the test, when given to a guilty athlete, had a 50% chance of revealing the doping violation. Then for every 1,000 athletes tested, 100 would have been guilty, and the test would have fingered 50 of those. Meanwhile, of the 900 athletes who are innocent, the test would have fingered 9. So what a positive doping test really meant was not that the probability she was guilty was 99%, but rather 50 out of 59 equaling 84.7%. Put another way, you should have about as much confidence that Slaney was guilty based on that evidence as you would that the number one wouldn't turn up when she tossed a die. That certainly leaves room for reasonable doubt, and more important, indicates that to perform mass testing, 90,000 athletes have their urine tested annually, and make judgments based on such a procedure means to condemn a large number of innocent people. In legal circles, the mistake of inversion is sometimes called the prosecutor's fallacy, because prosecutors often employ that type of fallacious argument to lead juries to convicting suspects on thin evidence. Consider, for example, the case in Britain of Sally Clark. Clark's first child died at 11 weeks. The death was reported as due to sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, a diagnosis that is made when the death of a baby is unexpected and a postmortem does not reveal a cause of death. Clark conceived again, and this time her baby died at 8 weeks, again reportedly of SIDS. When that happened, she was arrested and accused of smothering both children. At the trial, the prosecution called in an expert pediatrician, Sir Roy Meadow, to testify that based on the rarity of SIDS, the odds of both children's dying from it was 73 million to 1. The prosecution offered no other substantive evidence against her. Should that have been enough to convict? The jury thought so, and in November 1999, Mrs. Clark was sent to prison. Sir Meadow had estimated that the odds that a child will die of SIDS are 1 in 8,543. He calculated his estimate of 73 million to 1 by multiplying two such factors, one for each child. But this calculation assumes that the deaths are independent, that is, that no environmental or genetic effects play a role that might increase a second child's risk once an older sibling has died of SIDS. In fact, in an editorial in the British Medical Journal a few weeks after the trial, the chances of two siblings dying of SIDS was estimated at 2.75 million to 1. Those are still very long odds. The key to understanding why Sally Clark was wrongly imprisoned is again to consider the inversion error. It is not the probability that two children will die of SIDS that we seek, but the probability that the two children who died, died of SIDS. 2 years after Clark was imprisoned, the Royal Statistical Society weighed in on this subject with a press release, declaring that the jury's decision was based on a serious error of logic, known as the prosecutor's fallacy. The jury needs to weigh up two competing explanations for the baby's deaths, SIDS or murder. Two deaths by SIDS or two murders are each quite unlikely, but one has apparently happened in this case. What matters is the relative likelihood of the deaths, not just how unlikely the SIDS explanation is. A mathematician later estimated the relative likelihood of a family's losing two babies by SIDS or by murder. He concluded, based on the available data, that two infants are 9 times more likely to be SIDS victims than murder victims. The Clarks appealed the case, and for the appeal, hired their own statisticians as expert witnesses. They lost the appeal, but they continued to seek medical explanations for the deaths, and in the process uncovered the fact that the pathologist working for the prosecution had withheld the fact that the second child had been suffering from a bacterial infection at the time of death, an infection that might have caused the infant's death. Based on that discovery, a judge quashed the conviction, and after nearly 3.5 years, Sally Clark was released from prison. The renowned attorney and Harvard Law School professor Alan Dershowitz also successfully employed the prosecutor's fallacy to help defend O.J. Simpson in his trial for the murder of Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and a male companion. The trial of Simpson, a former football star, was one of the biggest media events of 1994-95. The police had plenty of evidence against him. They found a bloody glove at his estate that seemed to match one found at the murder scene. Bloodstains matching Nicole's blood were found on the gloves, in his white Ford Bronco, on a pair of socks in his bedroom, and in his driveway and house. Moreover, DNA samples taken from blood at the crime scene matched OJ's. The defense could do little more than accuse the Los Angeles Police Department of racism. OJ is African American. And criticize the integrity of the police and the authenticity of their evidence. The prosecution made a decision to focus the opening of its case on OJ's propensity toward violence against Nicole. Prosecutors spent the first 10 days of the trial entering evidence of his history of abusing her and claimed that this alone was a good reason to suspect him of her murder. As they put it, a slap is a prelude to homicide. The defense attorneys used this strategy as the launchpad for their accusations of duplicity, arguing that the prosecution had spent 2 weeks trying to mislead the jury and that the evidence that OJ had battered Nicole on previous occasions meant nothing. Here is Dershowitz's reasoning. 4 million women are battered annually by husbands and boyfriends in the United States. Yet in 1992, according to the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, a total of 1,432, or 1 in 2,500, were killed by their husbands or boyfriends. Therefore, the defense retorted, few men who slap or beat their domestic partners go on to murder them. True? Yes. Convincing? Yes. Relevant? No. The relevant number is not the probability that a man who batters his wife will go on to kill her, 1 in 2,500, but rather the probability that a battered wife who was murdered by her abuser. According to the Uniform Crime Reports for the United States and its possessions in 1993, the probability Dershowitz or the prosecution should have reported was this one. Of all the battered women murdered in the United States in 1993, some 90% were killed by their abuser. That statistic was not mentioned at the trial. As the hour of the verdict's announcement approached, long-distance call volume dropped by half, trading volume on the New York Stock Exchange fell by 40%, and an estimated 100 million people turned to their televisions and radios to hear the verdict. Not guilty. Dershowitz may have felt justified in misleading the jury because, in his words, the courtroom oath, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, is applicable only to witnesses. Defense attorneys, prosecutors, and judges don't take this oath. Indeed, it is fair to say the American justice system is built on a foundation of not telling the whole truth. Though conditional probability represents a revolution in ideas about randomness, Thomas Bayes was no revolutionary, and his work languished unattended despite its publication in the prestigious Philosophical Transactions in 1764. And so it fell to another man, the French scientist and mathematician, Pierre-Simon de Laplace, to bring Bayes' ideas to scientists' attention and fulfill the goal of revealing to the world how the probabilities that underlie real-world situations could be inferred from the outcomes we observe. You may remember that Bernoulli's Golden Theorem will tell you before you conduct a series of coin tosses how certain you can be, if the coin is fair, that you will observe some given outcome. You may also remember that it will not tell you after you've made a given series of tosses the chances that the coin was a fair one. Along the same lines, if you know that the chances that an 85-year-old will survive to 90 are 50 out of 50, the Golden Theorem tells you the probability that half the 85-year-olds in a group of 1,000 will die in the next 5 years. But if half the people in some group died in the 5 years after their 85th birthday, it cannot tell you how likely it is that the underlying chances of survival for the people in that group were 50 over 50. Or if Ford knows that 1 in 100 of its automobiles has a defective transmission, the Golden Theorem can tell Ford the chances that, in a batch of 1,000 autos, 10 or more of the transmissions will be defective. But if Ford finds 10 defective transmissions in a sample of 1,000 autos, it does not tell the automaker the likelihood that the average number of defective transmissions is 1 in 100. In these cases, it is the latter scenario that is more often useful in life. Outside situations involving gambling, we are not normally provided with theoretical knowledge of the odds, but rather must estimate them after making a series of observations. Scientists, too, find themselves in this position. They do not generally seek to know, given the value of a physical quantity, the probability that a measurement will come out one way or another, but instead seek to discern the true value of a physical quality, given a set of measurements. I have stressed this distinction because it is an important one. It defines the fundamental difference between probability and statistics. The former concerns predictions based on fixed probabilities. The latter concerns the inference of those probabilities based on observed data. It is the latter set of issues that was addressed by Laplace. He was not aware of Bayes' theory and therefore had to reinvent it. As he framed it, the issue was this: given a series of measurements, what is the best guess you can make of the true value of the measured quantity, and what are the chances that this guess will be near the true value, however demanding you are in your definition of near? Laplace's analysis began with a paper in 1774, but spread over 4 decades. A brilliant and sometimes generous man, he also occasionally borrowed without acknowledgement from the works of others and was a tireless self-promoter. Most important, though, Laplace was a flexible reed that bent with the breeze, a characteristic that allowed him to continue his groundbreaking work virtually undisturbed by the turbulent events transpiring around him. Prior to the French Revolution, Laplace obtained the lucrative post of examiner to the Royal Artillery, in which he had the luck to examine a promising 16-year-old candidate named Napoleon Bonaparte. When the Revolution came in 1789, he fell briefly under suspicion, but unlike many others, emerged unscathed, declaring his inextinguishable hatred to royalty, and eventually winning new honors from the Republic. Then, when his acquaintance Napoleon crowned himself emperor in 1804, he immediately shed his republicanism and in 1806 was given the title Count. After the Bourbons returned, Laplace slammed Napoleon in the 1814 edition of his treatise The Theory of Analytic Probabilities, writing that the fall of empires, which aspire to universal dominion, could be predicted with very high probability by one versed in the calculus of chance. The previous, 1812 edition, had been dedicated to Napoleon the Great. Laplace's political dexterity was fortunate for mathematics, for in the end his analysis was richer and more complete than Bayes's. With the foundation provided by Laplace's work, in the next chapter, we shall leave the realm of probability and enter that of statistics. Their joining point is one of the most important curves in all of mathematics and science, the Bell curve, otherwise known as the normal distribution. That, and the new theory of measurement that came with it, are the subjects of the following chapter. Chapter 7, Measurement and the Law of Errors. One day not long ago, my son Alexei came home and announced the grade on his most recent English essay. He had received a 93. Under normal circumstances, I would have congratulated him on earning an A. And since it was a low A and I know him to be capable of better, I would have added that this grade was evidence that if he put in a little effort, he could score even higher next time. But these were not normal circumstances, and in this case I considered the grade of 93 to be a shocking underestimation of the quality of the essay. At this point, you might think that the previous few sentences tell you more about me than about Alexei. If so, you're right on target. In fact, the above episode is entirely about me, for it was I who wrote Alexei's essay. Okay, shame on me. In my defense, I should point out that I would normally no sooner write Alexei's essays than take a foot to the chin for him in his kung fu class. But Alexei had come to me for a critique of his work, and as usual presented his request late on the night before the paper was due. I told him I'd get back to him. Proceeding to read it on the computer, I first made a couple of minor changes. Nothing worth bothering to note. Then, being a relentless rewriter, I gradually found myself sucked in, rearranging this and rewriting that, and before I finished, not only had he fallen asleep, but I had made the essay my own. The next morning, sheepishly admitting that I had neglected to perform a save as on the original, I told him to just go ahead and turn in my version. He handed me the graded paper with a few words of encouragement. "Not bad," he told me. "A 93 is really more of an A- than an A, but it was late, and I'm sure if you were more awake, you would have done better." I was not happy. First of all, it is unpleasant when a 15-year-old says the very words to you that you have previously said to him, and nevertheless you find his words inane. But beyond that, how could my material, the work of a person whom my mother, at least, thinks of as a professional writer, not make the grade in a high school English class? Apparently, I am not alone. Since then, I have been told of another writer who had a similar experience, except his daughter received a B. Apparently, the writer, with a PhD in English, writes well enough for Rolling Stone, Esquire, and the New York Times, but not for English 101. Alexei tried to comfort me with another story. Two of his friends, he said, once turned in identical essays. He thought that was stupid and they'd both be suspended, but not only did the overworked teacher not notice, she gave one of the essays a 90, an A, and the other a 79, a C. Sounds odd unless, like me, you've had the experience of staying up all night grading a tall stack of papers with Star Trek reruns playing in the background to break the monotony. Numbers always seem to carry the weight of authority. The thinking, at least subliminally, goes like this. If a teacher awards grades on a 100-point scale, those tiny distinctions must really mean something. But if 10 publishers could deem the manuscript for the first Harry Potter book unworthy of publication, how could poor Mrs. Finnegan, not her real name, distinguish so finely between essays as to award one a 92 and another a 93? If we accept that the quality of an essay is somehow definable, we must still recognize that a grade is not a description of an essay's degree of quality, but rather a measurement of it. And one of the most important ways randomness affects us is through its influence on measurement. In the case of the essay, the measurement apparatus was the teacher, and a teacher's assessment, like any measurement, is susceptible to random variance and error. Voting is also a kind of measurement. In that case, we are measuring not simply how many people support each candidate on election day, but how many care enough to take the trouble to vote. There are many sources of random error in this measurement. Some legitimate voters might find that their name is not on the rolls of registered voters. Others mistakenly vote for a candidate other than the one intended. And of course, there are errors in counting the votes. Some ballots are improperly accepted or rejected. Others are simply lost. In most elections, the sum of all these factors doesn't add up to enough to affect the outcome. But in close elections, it can. And then we usually go through one or more recounts, as if our second or third counting of the votes will be less affected by random errors than our first. In the 2004 governor's race in the state of Washington, for example, The Democratic candidate was eventually declared the winner, although the original tally had the Republican winning by 261 votes out of about 3 million. The original vote count was so close, state law required a recount. In that count, the Republican won again, but only by 42 votes. It is not known whether anyone thought it was a bad sign that the 219-vote difference between the first and second vote counts was several times larger than the new margin of victory. But the upshot was a third vote count, this one entirely by hand. The 42-vote victory amounted to an edge of just one vote out of each 70,000 cast. So, the hand-counting effort could be compared to asking 42 people to count from 1 to 70,000 and then hoping they averaged less than one mistake each. Not surprisingly, the result changed again. This time it favored the Democrat by 10 votes. That number was later changed to 129, then 700 newly discovered lost votes were included. Neither the vote counting process nor the voting process is perfect. If, for instance, owing to post office mistakes, 1 in 100 prospective voters didn't get the mailer with the location of the polling place, and 1 in 100 of those people did not vote because of it, in the Washington election, that would have amounted to 300 voters who would have voted but didn't because of government error. Elections, like all measurements, are imprecise, and so are the recounts. So when elections come out extremely close, perhaps we ought to accept them as is, or flip a coin, rather than conducting recount after recount. The imprecision of measurement became a major issue in the mid-18th century, when one of the primary occupations of those working in celestial physics and mathematics was the problem of reconciling Newton's laws with the observed motions of the moon and planets. One way to produce a single number from a set of discordant measurements is to take the average, or mean. It seems to have been young Isaac Newton who, in his optical investigations, first employed it for that purpose. But, as in many things, Newton was an anomaly. Most scientists in Newton's day, and in the following century, didn't take the mean. Instead, they chose the single golden number from among their measurements, the number they deemed mainly by hunch to be the most reliable result they had. That's because they regarded variation in measurement not as the inevitable byproduct of the measuring process, but as evidence of failure, with at times even moral consequences. In fact, they rarely published multiple measurements of the same quantity, feeling it would amount to the admission of a botched process and raise the issue of trust. But in the mid-18th century, the tide began to change. Calculating the gross motion of heavenly bodies, a series of nearly circular ellipses, is a simple task performed today by precocious high school students as music blares through their headphones. But to describe planetary motion in its finer points, taking into account not only the gravitational pull of the sun, but also that of the other planets and the deviation of the planets and the moon from a perfectly spherical shape, is even today a difficult problem. To accomplish that goal, complex and approximate mathematics had to be reconciled with imperfect observation and measurement. There was another reason why the late 18th century demanded a mathematical theory of measurement. Beginning in the 1780s, in France, a new mode of rigorous experimental physics had arisen. Before that period, physics consisted of two separate traditions. On the one hand, mathematical scientists investigated the precise consequences of Newton's theories of motion and gravity. On the other, a group sometimes described as experimental philosophers performed empirical investigations of electricity, magnetism, light, and heat. The experimental philosophers, often amateurs, were less focused on the rigorous methodology of science than were the mathematics-oriented researchers. And so a movement arose to reform and mathematize experimental physics. In it, Pierre Simon de Laplace again played a major role. Laplace had become interested in physical science through the work of his fellow Frenchman, Antoine Laurent Lavoisier, considered the father of modern chemistry. Laplace and Lavoisier worked together for years, but Lavoisier did not prove as adept as Laplace at navigating the troubled times. To earn money to finance his many scientific experiments, he had become a member of a privileged private association of state-protected tax collectors. There is probably no time in history when having such a position would inspire your fellow citizens to invite you into their homes for a nice hot cup of gingerbread cappuccino. But when the French Revolution came, it proved an especially onerous credential. In 1794, Lavoisier was arrested with the rest of the association and quickly sentenced to death. Ever the dedicated scientist, he requested time to complete some of his research so that it would be available to posterity. To that, the presiding judge famously replied, "The Republic has no need of scientists." The father of modern chemistry was promptly beheaded, his body tossed into a mass grave. He had reportedly instructed his assistant to count the number of words his severed head would attempt to mouth. Laplace's and Lavoisier's work, along with that of a few others, especially the French physicist Charles-Augustin de Coulomb, who experimented on electricity and magnetism, transformed experimental physics. Their work also contributed to the development in the 1790s of a new rational system of units, the metric system, to replace the disparate systems that had impeded science and were a frequent cause of dispute among merchants. Developed by a group appointed by Louis XVI, the metric system was adopted by the revolutionary government after Louis's downfall. Lavoisier, ironically, had been one of the group's members. The demands of both astronomy and experimental physics meant that a great part of the mathematician's task in the late 18th and early 19th centuries was understanding and quantifying random error. Those efforts led to a new field, mathematical statistics, which provides a set of tools for the interpretation of the data that arise from observation and experimentation. Statisticians sometimes view the growth of modern science as revolving around that development, the creation of a theory of measurement. But statistics also provides tools to address real-world issues, such as the effectiveness of drugs or the popularity of politicians, so a proper understanding of statistical reasoning is as useful in everyday life as it is in science. It is one of those contradictions of life that although measurement always carries uncertainty, the uncertainty in measurement is rarely discussed when measurements are quoted. If a fastidious traffic cop tells the judge her radar gun clocked you going 39 in a 35-mile-per-hour zone, the ticket will usually stick despite the fact that readings from radar guns often vary by several miles per hour. And though many students, along with their parents, would jump off the roof if doing so would raise their 598 on a math SAT to 625, few educators talk about the studies showing that if you want to gain 30 points, there's a good chance you can do it simply by taking the test a couple more times. Sometimes meaningless distinctions even make the news. One recent August, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the unemployment rate stood at 4.7%. In July, the Bureau had reported the rate at 4.8%. The change prompted headlines like this one in the New York Times. Jobs and wages increased modestly last month. But as Gene Epstein, the economics editor of Barron's, put it, merely because the number has changed, it doesn't necessarily mean that a thing itself has changed. For example, any time the unemployment rate moves by a tenth of a percentage point, that is a change that is so small, there is no way to tell whether there really was a change. In other words, if the Bureau of Labor Statistics measures the unemployment rate in August and then repeats its measurement an hour later, By random error alone, there is a good chance that the second measurement will differ from the first by at least a tenth of a percentage point. Would the New York Times then run the headline, "Jobs and Wages Increased Modestly by 2 p.m.?" The uncertainty in measurement is even more problematic when the quantity being measured is subjective. Like Alexei's English class essay. For instance, a group of researchers at Clarion University of Pennsylvania collected 120 term papers and treated them with a degree of scrutiny you can be certain your own child's work will never receive. Each term paper was scored independently by 8 faculty members. The resulting grades on a scale from A to F sometimes varied by 2 or more grades. On average, they differed by nearly 1 grade. Since a student's future often depends on such judgments, the imprecision is unfortunate. Yet it is understandable given that, in their approach and philosophy, the professors in any given college department often run the gamut from Karl Marx to Groucho Marx. But what if we control for that? That is, if the graders are given and instructed to follow a certain fixed grading criteria. A researcher at Iowa State University presented about 100 students' essays to a group of doctoral students in rhetoric and professional communication, whom he had trained extensively according to such criteria. 2 independent assessors graded each essay on a scale of 1 to 4. When the scores were compared, the assessors agreed in only about half the cases. Similar results were found by the University of Texas in an analysis of its scores on college entrance essays. Even the venerable College Board expects only that, when assessed by 2 raters, 92% of all scored essays will receive ratings within plus or minus 1 point of each other on the 6-point SAT essay scale. Another subjective measurement that is given more credence than it warrants is the rating of wines. Back in the 1970s, the wine business was a sleepy enterprise, growing but mainly in the sales of low-grade jug wines. Then, in 1978, an event often credited with the rapid growth of that industry occurred. A lawyer-turned-self-proclaimed wine critic, Robert M. Parker Jr., decided that, in addition to his reviews, he would rate wines numerically on a 100-point scale. Over the years, most other wine publications followed suit. Today, annual wine sales in the United States exceed $20 billion, and millions of wine aficionados won't lay their money on the counter without first looking to a wine's rating to support their choice. So when Wine Spectator awarded, say, the 2004 Valentin Bianchi Argentine Cabernet Sauvignon a 90 rather than an 89, that single extra point translated into a huge difference in Valentin Bianchi sales. In fact, if you look at your local wine shop, you'll find that the sale and bargain wines, owing to their lesser appeal, are often the wines rated in the high 80s. But what are the chances that the 2004 Valentin Bianchi Argentine Cabernet that received a 90 would have received an 89 if the rating process had been repeated, say, an hour later? In his 1890 book, The Principles of Psychology, William James suggested that wine expertise could extend to the ability to judge whether a sample of Madeira came from the top or the bottom of a bottle. In the wine tastings that I've attended over the years, I've noticed that if the bearded fellow to my left mutters, a great nose, the wine smells good, others certainly might chime in their agreement. But if you make your notes independently and without discussion, you often find that the bearded fellow wrote, great nose, and the guy with the shaved head scribbled, no nose, and the blonde woman with the perm wrote, interesting nose with hints of parsley and freshly tanned leather. From the theoretical viewpoint, there are many reasons to question the significance of wine ratings. For one thing, taste perception depends on a complex interaction between taste and olfactory stimulation. Strictly speaking, the sense of taste comes from 5 types of receptor cells on the tongue: salty, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami. The last responds to certain amino acid compounds, prevalent, for example, in soy sauce. But if that were all there was to taste perception, you could mimic everything. Your favorite steak, baked potato, an apple pie feast, or a nice spaghetti bolognese, employing only table salt, sugar, vinegar, quinine, and monosodium glutamate. Fortunately, there is more to gluttony than that, and that is where the sense of smell comes in. The sense of smell explains why, if you take two identical solutions of sugar water and add to one a sugar-free essence of strawberry, it will taste sweeter than the other. The perceived taste of wine arises from the effects of a stew of between 600 and 800 volatile organic compounds on both the tongue and the nose. That's a problem, given that studies have shown that even flavor-trained professionals can rarely, reliably, identify more than three or four components in a mixture. Expectations also affect your perception of taste. In 1963, three researchers secretly added a bit of red food color to white wine to give it the blush of a rosé. They then asked a group of experts to rate its sweetness in comparison with the untinted wine. The experts perceived the fake rosé as sweeter than the white, according to their expectation. Another group of researchers gave a group of oenology students two wine samples. Both samples contained the same white wine, but to one was added a tasteless grape anthocyanin dye that made it appear to be red wine. The students also perceived differences between the red and the white corresponding to their expectations. And in a 2008 study, a group of volunteers asked to rate five wines rated a bottle labeled $90 higher than another bottle labeled $10, even though the sneaky researchers had filled both bottles with the same wine. What's more, this test was conducted while the subjects were having their brains imaged in a magnetic resonance scanner. The scan showed that the area of the brain thought to encode our experience of pleasure was truly more active when the subjects drank the wine they believed was more expensive. But before you judge the enophiles, consider this. When a researcher asked 30 cola drinkers whether they preferred Coke or Pepsi, and then asked them to test their performance by tasting both brands side by side, 21 of the 30 reported that the taste test confirmed their choice, even though this sneaky researcher had put Coke in the Pepsi bottle and vice versa. When we perform an assessment or measurement, our brains do not rely solely on direct perceptional input. They also integrate other sources of information, such as our expectation. Wine tasters are also often fooled by the flip side of the expectancy bias, lack of context. Holding a chunk of horseradish under your nostril, you'd probably not mistake it for a clove of garlic, nor would you mistake a clove of garlic for, say, the inside of your sneaker. But if you sniff clear liquid scents, all bets are off. In the absence of context, there's a good chance you'd mix the scents up. At least that's what happened when two researchers presented experts with a series of 16 random odors. The experts misidentified about one out of every four scents. Given all these reasons for skepticism, scientists designed ways to measure wine experts' taste discrimination directly. One method is to use a wine triangle. It is not a physical triangle, but a metaphor. Each expert is given three wines, two of which are identical. The mission? To choose the odd sample. In a 1990 study, the experts identified the odd sample only two-thirds of the time, which means that in one out of three taste challenges, these wine gurus couldn't distinguish a Pinot Noir with, say, an exuberant nose of wild strawberry, luscious blackberry and raspberry, from one with the scent of distinctive dried plums, yellow cherries, and silky cassis. In the same study, an ensemble of experts was asked to rank a series of wines based on 12 components, such as alcohol content, the presence of tannins, sweetness, and fruitiness. The experts disagreed significantly on 9 of the 12 components. Finally, when asked to match wines with the descriptions provided by other experts, the subjects were correct only 70% of the time. Wine critics are conscious of all these difficulties. On many levels, the rating system is nonsensical, says the editor of Wine and Spirits magazine. And according to a former editor of Wine Enthusiast, the deeper you get into this, the more you realize how misguided and misleading this all is. Yet, the rating system thrives. Why? The critics found that when they attempted to encapsulate wine quality with a system of stars or simple verbal descriptors such as good, bad, and maybe ugly, their opinions were unconvincing. But when they used numbers, shoppers worshipped their pronouncements. Numerical ratings, though dubious, make buyers confident that they can pick the golden needle, or the silver one, depending on their budget, from the haystack of wine varieties, makers, and vintages. If a wine, or an essay, truly admits some measure of quality that can be summarized by a number, a theory of measurement must address two key issues. How do we determine that number from a series of varying measurements? And given a limited set of measurements, how can we assess the probability that our determination is correct? We now turn to these questions, for whether the source of data is objective or subjective, their answers are the goal of the theory of measurement. The key to understanding measurement is understanding the nature of the variation in data caused by random error. Suppose we offer a number of wines to 15 critics, or we offer the wines to one critic repeatedly on different days, or we do both. We can neatly summarize the opinions employing the average or mean of the ratings. But it is not just the mean that matters. If all 15 critics agree that the wine is a 90, that sends one message. If the critics produce the ratings 80, 81, 82, 87, 89, 89, 90, 90, 90, 91, 91, 94, 97, 99, and 100, that sends another. Both sets of data have the same mean, but they differ in the amount they vary from that mean. Since the manner in which data points are distributed is such an important piece of information, mathematicians created a numerical measure of variation to describe it. That number is called the sample standard deviation. Mathematicians also measure the variation by its square, which is called the sample variance. The sample standard deviation characterizes how close to the mean a set of data clusters, or, in practical terms, the uncertainty of the data. When it is low, the data fall near the mean. For the data in which all wine critics rated the wine 90, for example, the sample standard deviation is 0, telling you that all the data are identical to the mean. When the sample standard deviation is high, however, the data are not clustered around the mean. For the set of wine ratings above that ranges from 80 to 100, the sample standard deviation is 6, meaning that as a rule of thumb, most of the ratings fall within 6 points of the mean. In that case, all you can really say about the wine is that it is probably somewhere between an 84 and a 96. In judging the meaning of their measurement, scientists in the 18th and 19th centuries faced the same issues as the skeptical oenophile. For if a group of researchers makes a series of observations, the results will almost always differ. One astronomer might suffer adverse atmospheric conditions. Another might be jostled by a breeze. A third might have just returned from a Madeira tasting with William James. In 1838, the mathematician and astronomer F.W. Bessel categorized 11 cases of random errors that occur in every telescopic observation. Even if a single astronomer makes repeated measurements, variables, such as unreliable eyesight, or the effect of temperature on the apparatus will cause the observations to vary. And so astronomers must understand how, given a series of discrepant measurements, they can determine a body's true position. But just because enophiles and scientists share a problem, it doesn't mean they can share its solution. Can we identify general characteristics of random error? Or does the character of random error depend on the context?